Scott Stevens, an award-winning journalist and international presenter who talks about addiction and especially alcohol addiction. We have already talked to Scott on two occasions. This is the third in the series that we're doing with him. And we previously talked about the advent of the opioid crisis and also its interrelationship to the gateway drug, alcohol. And in the last segment, we talked about some of the negative effects of alcohol on the individual and on the healthcare cost of the country as a whole. So now we're going to get back into it at that point and get you some more information. Scott, it's nice to have you on the show again.
Dr. Henderson, thank you for having me back. I enjoy the conversation that we've had, and you know, beginning to talk about the health consequences and looking at that Franklin chart that you've started with your listeners. This is the meat of the matter right here.
Okay. Well, the Franklin chart, you can go back, and if you didn't get segments 1 and 2, listen to them. We set up a chart that you can put in on the left-hand side, the risk associated with drinking alcohol, and on the right-hand side, the benefits of drinking alcohol. And the title is, Should I Drink Alcohol? And so I will be telling you as we go along what I'm putting on my copy, and you can be making a copy for yourself at home. Now, Scott, we talked about alcohol as a cause of cancer, heart disease, cirrhosis last time. The next one is stroke. How does alcohol relate to stroke?
Stroke is such an important part of this conversation because it barely ever enters into the conversation about alcohol. And where we look at the number of strokes in the United States, strokes are more common than breast cancer in the United States. And of course, we do spend a lot of public attention on breast cancer, alcohol being the only dietary connection ever made to an increased risk for breast cancer. But hey, how about strokes? Strokes are more common than breast cancer. 1 in 5 strokes is alcohol related. And that was based on a University of Eastern Finland study about 5 or 6 years ago is when I came across it. And it's shown through repetition over the years that with a decade or more of follow-up or a decade or more pre-existing research on this, that it increases stroke risk. The first drink, from the time you take your first drink, your risk is doubled and remains elevated for the next 2 hours. Now, that's just one drink. We're talking about either gender, and obviously that would apply in moderation, or if you continue drinking, your stroke risk is going to be elevated. And that's a part of, you know, looking at the alcohol impact on the cardiovascular system in general, the progression of atherosclerosis over that time period is higher for people who can consume a six pack or six drinks or more on a single evening or a single session. You know, it's stroke risk. If you could also tie this to hangovers. How many hangovers did you have last year? Well, it increases among stroke risk increases among men who have at least one hangover a year. And, you know, the crowd I used to hang with, I mean, the hangover was a nearly weekly experience for them. So if you look at overall the damage for stroke, for people between 18 and 44 years of age, I mean, that's where there's a tremendous growth in the number of strokes in the United States. These are young people. We ordinarily associate stroke with people with gray hair around their temples like myself. But strokes are happening more frequently and at a younger age, and the connection is one in five of them are alcohol-related.
So if I understand you correctly, what you're telling me is that if you take one drink, and that could be beer, wine, or spirits, mm-hmm. you will have, over the next 2 hours, an increased risk of having a stroke as if you had not taken that drink.
Mm-hmm. So, yep. Just even that small amount doubles your risk for the next 2 hours.
Doubles the risk, okay. And then I would assume that if you continue to drink, the risk would still stay elevated as long as you're drinking?
As long as you're drinking, or as long as that alcohol is in your system. From a medical standpoint, it takes anywhere from an hour to 90 minutes to for your liver to process the alcohol that's in your bloodstream. So while that alcohol is in your bloodstream and while the part of the oxidation of alcohol, turning it from alcohol into acetaldehyde, you know, that chemical, as we mentioned in episode 2, is 30 times more toxic than the alcohol it came from. So while those two toxins are in your body, alcohol and acetaldehyde, your stroke risk and your risk for other organ damage or systemic damage remains elevated. So as long as it's in your body, until your liver does its job.
So is there a correlation between acetaldehyde and formaldehyde?
Same molecular structure in the aldehyde family, where it contains carbon and hydrogen and oxygen molecules. Not a direct, they're cousins, but they're not family.
Yeah, I just remember that formaldehyde can pickle your tissue, and
yeah,
I was just wondering.
You know, I did a video. Boy, this was around the time of my second or third book, looking at the effect of just immersing healthy tissue in alcohol, and I used a piece of pork. Now, granted, this is not a live piece of tissue. This is a fresh piece of pork, but it turned that support gray in the 2 minutes of that segment, and it's very damaging to the cellular material if it's practically cooking that meat in that kind of time. So acetaldehyde being 30 times stronger than the alcohol, you can just imagine what it's doing to ordinarily healthy tissues.
Okay, so now on your Franklin chart, you have the opportunity to put down alcohol as a stroke risk or a benefit, and I'm sure that you're going to put it down as a risk. But think of this. You probably never thought of this before. Is it worth one drink to have a stroke, to not be able to use your arm or your leg or not be able to talk or can't even use your brain properly? Is one drink worth that increased risk? Only you can answer that question, but put it down the way that you see it on Benjamin Franklin's chart, and we'll go on.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I like to point out, and frequently when I'm doing discussions with medical professionals, is that, you know, we look at cause of death in the United States, and where the CDC comes up with a number is around 90,000 are alcohol related. But if you look at what we were just talking about, one in five strokes is alcohol related, and the cause of death in those cases is going to be listed as stroke. It's not going to be listed as alcohol. So the number that the CDC bears out is 90,000, and I believe that number is about 10% of the actual number when you factor in the things we've already talked about with cancer and alcohol's relation to cancer, when you talk about heart disease and alcohol and with its direct line relationship to heart disease. And here with strokes, if we have 1.5 million strokes in the United States and one in five of them is alcohol related, you know, when we look at fatalities and we look at the health consequences of even moderate drinking, that number of 90,000 from the CDC is very, very underreported.
You said that 70% of adults used alcohol last year, and that a majority of your insurance healthcare dollar was used to mitigate the expense of drinking. And but it's not just the expense of the person that's drinking the alcohol. It's also the expense of the people that they hurt by drinking alcohol, right?
Mm-hmm. When I brought forward the statistic that 2 hospital admissions every minute are alcohol-related, that is the drinker and or their victims. So in the case of, for example, a car wreck, they're not accidents, or a household disaster, whether it's passing out, falling down, taking a tumble and taking somebody with you. I mean, these are other alcohol-related injuries or illnesses in addition to beyond just the person who's doing the drinking. By and large, though, much of it is the person who's subjecting their body to a toxin and known carcinogen.
Well, let's talk about binge drinking. Would you first define what binge drinking is?
Binge drinking is, if we look at the so-called normal or recommended amounts of alcohol, being 1 drink a day for women, 2 drinks a day for men. By the book, it's anything more than that, but statistically what we look at is a person who's consuming 6 or more drinks in a session or an evening or an afternoon. So frankly, that amount is a little bit skewed. It's if when we're talking about binge drinkers, we're really talking about a serious consumption of much more than 6, but 6 is the clinical standard by which these are measured here, 6 or more drinks in a single session.
And binge drinking...
The damage.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Binge drinking, you said, accounts for more than 75% of all the costs related to excessive alcohol use.
That is correct. And when we look at the term binge drinking, you know, that takes into account drinking alcoholically. In my case, when I was practicing my craft, so to speak, that was day in, day out, at least 2 liters of Jack Daniels every single day. But no, you don't have to drink that much to be considered a binge drinker. Binge drinking... Excuse me. The phenomenon of binge drinking, that could be once a week where you just go hell-bent for leather out after Thursday or Friday night with your coworkers and being overserved, as they call it. But, it doesn't have to be a day-in, day-out thing. It can be once a week. And people say, well, I only drink on Fridays. Well, the amount you're drinking on that Friday is doing even more damage than being a daily drinker would.
And so about 18% of adults in America are binge drinkers. That means that they drink from time to time more than 5 drinks in one episode. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so,
correct.
So binge drinking increases your risk of hurting yourself. It also increases your risk of hurting somebody else. It increases the cost to the... society of medical care for you and the other people, and a significant amount of people do it. So ask yourself, do I ever binge drink, or do I stop with 1 or 2 drinks always? And that's something that probably you haven't asked yourself and don't know the answer to that, but you may be a binge drinker, and a majority of binge drinkers are alcoholics. So here we get into defining the problem a little bit more critically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you said there are no documented health benefits to consuming beverage alcohol. And I remember doctors saying, well, your heart is helped by drinking one or possibly two glasses of red wine every evening. Now, what do you say to that?
Oh, that was a fantastic piece of mythology there, partially funded by, who guessed it, the wine industry. And as we look at, you know, following the money in all of these studies, you do have to look at who's funding the study. In that case, and it was discredited about 10 years ago, this phenomenon of red wine being good for the heart really traces to the substance called resveratrol, which can be found in the skin of grapes. And red wine, obviously, they use the skin in the pressing and the fermentation process of making red wine. Well, by doing that, by fermenting it, you also put in alcohol content. And alcohol content is exactly the opposite of what resveratrol does. It's terrible for the heart. So the lesson here is, A, follow the money, and B, if you want the resveratrol, eat the grapes, don't ferment them.
Yeah, and you can get them at the, you can get pills or capsules or something in the health food store of that particular supplement.
I noticed that. I was in GNC the other day, one of those vitamin supplement stores, and they had a supplement capsule of resveratrol, which is, it's great. And, you know, when people look at those things that are beneficial for the heart, alcohol not being one of them, but by all means, you know, with a consult with a legit doctor who's going to say, you know, hey, well, here's what we know about resveratrol. This is the part of the red wine that's good for you, but the alcohol part isn't going to, it's just going to counteract any benefit that you would receive from it. In fact, you'd probably have to drink a barrel of wine just to get the kind of benefit that you're looking for if you think of resveratrol as a miracle drug.
Right. And resveratrol won't kill you or kill somebody else, I don't think.
So true. Not, certainly not behind the wheel. And,
yeah.
You know, who knows? Who knows what the ingestion does over a period of time? But you know, that ship hasn't sailed yet. But it's way better than consuming the red wine.
Let's talk about the rate of alcoholism in the country. Where would you put that?
About 12%. And that's, you know, getting there, you can have this genetic predisposition to alcoholism. However, no alcoholic ever became alcoholic taking the first drink. And that's a large part of the emphasis of my work, is looking at when does that first drink happen, and how can we put that further down the road and put a component of education in there to perhaps prevent the kind of health damage and the risk of addiction further down the road. But with the genetic predisposition also comes the part of alcohol in that it can alter your DNA. So you can be born with a predisposition to alcoholism, or you can drink your way into this disease. But the 12% number, that's a CDC number as well. And we look at the percentage of people who want to stop but can't. And as I define alcoholism and looking at both DSM-IV, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, that used to be the guidepost for mental illness and disease, and also the DSM-5, which kind of changed the definition here. But an alcoholic is somebody who wants to quit but can't. An alcohol abuser can quit but won't. And here kind of ties into how I've titled my books, is that, yeah, it's a play on words, but if you look at it, with a person who has a chemical dependency, they are drinking to feed that disease. They're drinking just to feel normal. And a person who doesn't have that can walk away from a second drink. One of the things that I speak at, when I speak at conferences, I speak to the fact that a test, and there are hundreds of tests out there that can determine if a person, by asking a certain set of questions, is or is not chemically dependent. And, of course, the challenge in all that is, well, we're only going to get as good a result as the person who's answering them is honest. And, frankly, a lot of drinkers aren't honest with themselves, let alone a test that's going to determine this. But if you want to get down to the nuts and bolts of this chemical dependency, limit yourself to 2 drinks a day. That's it. No borrowing from tomorrow. And it's certainly not encouraging people to drink, but if you're questioning it, limit yourself to 2 drinks. No borrowing from tomorrow, no stocking up for the weekend. And if you can do it, you're probably not chemically dependent. But in the situation with a person with the disease of alcoholism, there's no way they stop at that second drink. Because we experience a phenomenon of craving that begins with that sip, with that first sip. That's why it's important for people, alcoholics in recovery, to not engage in that first sip, because that's when the craving starts. Once you have that taste.
Yeah.
And we crave more after 10 drinks than a drinker or non-alcoholic craves before their first one.
Now, you said that alcohol use is the third ranking cause of preventable illness and death in the United States. And that being the case, I would put over in my risk column, third cause of preventable illness and death. So if you don't want to get ill and you don't want to die, one of the things that you can do is stop drinking. And so on my list, on the Ben Franklin list, I would put that down as a risk.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, it shortens your life expectancy.
Yeah. Well, you know, this goes into my work with addiction, and one of the things that would keep you from being addicted to any of 30 different behaviors is that you have a sufficient self-image that's high enough that you're not needing the alcohol or some other substance to make you feel better or make you feel normal or whatever like that. And I define addiction as when you understand that some behavior that you're doing is hurting you or someone you love, and you can't stop it for whatever reason you want to give, you're addicted to that behavior. And as we go through this Benjamin Franklin chart and everything, if you're logical and you're not psychotic, there is no way that you're going to say, well, alcohol doesn't harm me, doesn't increase my risk of illness or death. It's impossible to do that. So you've been warned. Now it's up to you to decide, can I stop drinking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So let's go on. 20 to 40% of general hospital beds are used for managing alcohol-related health complications. So that would seem to me that if our health care system is getting toward crisis with respect to how many dollars are being pumped into it to keep it going, that one of the ways of solving that problem or help solving that problem would be for a significant number of people in the country not to drink alcohol.
Exactly. In part of our overall dialogue about the healthcare access and affordability, is we have to look at the cost drivers. And if 20 to 40% of our hospital beds are going to be are utilized for the treatment of alcohol-related complications, then by all means, let's look at addressing the cost driver rather than just getting those people in and out of the hospital as quickly as we can. Because if they're still drinking, they're going to be back. It slows healing time for one. So whether it's a broken bone, compromised skin tissue, and or a bigger, larger treatment, so such as, not limited to mental illness, but such as heart disease, you know, these things are only complicated by continuing to drink. So the people return to the hospital again and again and again. But the things that get them into the hospital at an earlier age and more frequently is the relationship with alcohol. So if we're looking at this big thing that we've been talking about since the Clintons were in the White House and our access and affordability of health care, this is a big part of it.
Right. Now, here's an interesting fact. The largest retailer of goods in our country is also the largest retailer of alcoholic beverages, and that retailer is Walmart. I didn't know that.
No question about it. And in the municipalities where they're allowed to sell, and there are some states that still have the alcohol commission where you have to buy it at their outlets, but Walmart is such a pervasive part of America, and every Walmart in the states where it's allowed, or the municipalities where they're allowed to have that liquor license, they have it, and they are that pervasive where when it comes to beer, wine, and hard liquor, all three of those categories, they're the top distributor.
Now, that's something to kind of keep in mind, where society is going with alcohol. Now, I know that the government cannot legislate morality. They tried it in the 20s in Prohibition, and it didn't work. Ronald Reagan's drug czar tried it in the 80s with substances, and it didn't work. That has to be an individual decision that people are going to make for their own good. And so since government can't get into it, perhaps doing programs like this, you and I can help people understand that the decision whether to drink or not is something that they're going to have to make, and they're going to have to take responsibility for what happens after they make that decision. And if you want to live a longer life, if you want to live a healthier life until you die, here's one good way of taking care of a good amount of that problem.
Mm-hmm. And the challenge with alcohol and the connection to morality, dating back to the temperance movement and all that, you know, that argument just, it's a failed argument. When we look at alcohol as a public health policy question, then, yeah, the government does have a role in that discussion. But also, what you're pointing out is we have a role in our personal health decisions. We have a role in our personal financial decisions and our personal social, legal, all those things combined. And what causes problems is one. If you're having health difficulties and have a relationship with alcohol, and we know that alcohol creates all these health problems, then the decision, like you said, to a logical person is knock it off. Financial as well, if we look at what we're paying, and all of us are paying more as a result of somebody else's alcohol consumption because of what it does to the cost of lost productivity in the United States. You know, there's a financial decision here. We all have skin in the game, but for many of us, it's going to come down to that personal decision, like you're pointing out. Not a moral one at all.
Right. There is no safe level for consuming a toxin, and alcohol is a known carcinogen and toxin. You said mm-hmm. in your book. So that would mean to me any alcohol is not safe. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. That's what I'm saying, and I'll stand by that. When I look at the great body of research, credible research that is out there, The health benefits do not exist. And when, for example, the Dr. Tim Naimi of Boston University said alcohol is this big preventable cancer risk factor that's hiding in plain sight. No amount is safe when it comes to the discussion of alcohol and its relationship to cancer. When we hear people with the credentials to say, you know, when it comes to cancer, an oncologist is going to tell you no amount is safe. Well, darn it, that's something to listen to. So in this body of evidence is growing and growing that say, okay, this is a toxin and it's a known carcinogen. No, in any amount, not just the binge drinker, not just the alcoholic, not just the guy who drinks Jack Daniels and not the guy who drinks wine. Any one of those formulations in any amount is going to have detrimental health consequences. And to call it safe, or what the alcohol industry is able to get away with these days, is drink responsibly. Well, is there a responsible way to drink a toxin and known carcinogen? Not to the thinking man.
Right, right. Okay, now tell us about the risk of alcohol use in osteoporosis later in your life.
And that's, your bones deteriorate, okay? That's the given fact, whether you use alcohol or not. But 2 or 3 ounces of alcohol every day, and, you know, a 12-ounce can of beer, for example, would have about, 0.3%, about 5% alcohol. So not every ounce in a glass of wine is going to be alcohol. Look at dosage here to get to that. What 2 or 3 ounces of alcohol every day would be 2 or 3 beers of a standard size, or two or three shots. But that's all it takes to block your body's ability in your small intestine to absorb calcium adequately. So as you drink, your bones, as yeah, they're deteriorating, but if you're blocking your body's ingestion of the calcium, which strengthens bones, you're not helping yourself. You're increasing your risk of osteoporosis. And vitamin D is an important part of this equation as well. That's important for calcium absorption, and you get vitamin D through a number of sources in addition to its relationship with sunlight, but it also by the alcoholic diet is not known for its great quantities of vitamin D or supplements. So you're also harming your body in that regard with its processing of calcium, which your bones need. And there are other hormones that are involved in bone health. Alcohol decreases estrogen in women, and you need estrogen as an important hormone to bone health, among other things. And in fact, as estrogen drops, the bone loss increases. So yeah, that's what we've seen with an older generation of women. I wrote about this quite a bit in Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, my second book, in talking about the hormones themselves and what the havoc that alcohol creates with the hormonal balance in your body. That's important to your bones, but everything else too.
So, I don't know the exact statistics, but a significant cause of death in older people is falling and breaking a hip.
Mm-hmm.
And you are more likely to break your hip if you have osteoporosis than if you don't. So, therefore, if you drank on a consistent basis enough alcohol to decrease your calcium uptake in your bones, then that's going to cause osteoporosis, and the osteoporosis will cause death when you fall and break your hip. So, just kind of keep that in mind, that that's another risk to to put on your Benjamin Franklin chart.
Yeah, it's a 2 plus 2 equals 6 kind of equation here, because you do have the decreased bone mass, a decreased bone density. And when you're drinking, impairment begins at 0.02. We've got this political compromise in the United States where we say, well, you're impaired for driving at 0.08. But physiologically, your reaction time and your balance begin to be compromised at the first drink at 0.02. So adding that into weakened bones, you know, you've become less stable on your feet, and when you lose your footing, you're more likely to break a leg. 2 plus 2 equals 6. It's ugly math. It doesn't work in arithmetic circles, but boy, does it work in alcohol circles.
Now, we talked about the risk associated with drinking and stroke, but there are other brain risks besides stroke, are there not?
Mm-hmm. First of all, this is a mind-altering drug, and we look at the brain-mind connection here. That certainly comes into play with the mental health aspects of it, but separating the mind here and talking about just the organ of the brain, alcohol as a central nervous system depressant is going to slow the communication or alter the communication between your brain cells, and even with moderate drinking, again, this injury can be lasting, permanent brain damage. We've all heard, okay, well, I'm going out drinking tonight, I'm going to kill a few brain cells. Well, you are killing brain cells. Your brain is still making them, but at a 40% slower clip. So you're not replenishing by continuing to bathe this organ in alcohol. You're not replenishing the cells that you're killing. Kind of ties into what we were saying earlier about the heart in episode 2. You know, the damage is cumulative, and you know, it's not. The brain is such a amazing organ, but it's not even strong.
Is there any evidence that you're aware of a relationship between drinking alcohol and dementia or Alzheimer's dementia?
Certainly for men. Early onset dementia is, the risk of that in men is increased with, drinking the recommended 2 drinks a day. If we adhere to the government standard on that one, early onset dementia is definitely a risk for men and their relationship with alcohol. But overall, if we look at what we're doing to this great organ and bathing it in a substance, the curative factors or the beneficial factors would be negligible, if at all. And certainly the damage that it does long term, not just in terms of dementia, but to the shape and form of the organ itself, is obvious that this is not a good thing for your brain. And we have, and they do this research with cadavers, where people with the disease of alcoholism have smaller brain mass. So, I mean, visibly damaged the tissue, not just the cognitive ability of the brain itself.
Do you think that alcohol, and we're not talking about after you become intoxicated, because I know that that's the case, but maybe drinking less than that negatively affects memory?
The memory connection. Clearly, you know, there's the phenomenon of blackouts where people have no ability to remember after a period of heavy drinking. But to a lesser extent, and this gets into brain regions and the ability for the brain to create new memories. And alcohol takes that capability slowly but surely away from the brain. So it has to do with the neurons in the hippocampus. It's a region of the brain that's associated with learning and the memory. And these things are, they're cumulative, again, where, you know, this part of your brain, and this is why I lecture frequently on youth drinking, that hippocampus, that part of your brain responsible for memory and learning, and, you know, that's still developing until you're 25. So if you're binging to beat all daylights in your college years, that, your brain is still forming then. So looking at the regions of the brain most affected by the use of alcohol, even in moderation, you're messing with one of your memory centers.
So, if you're saying to yourself, you know, my memory's getting worse. I can't remember where I put my car keys. I can't remember this, that, or the other. Well, there's a lot of things that contribute to that, but wouldn't it be wise for you to make a decision to stop drinking alcohol and see if that improved your memory? It's certainly not going to hurt you to make that test. And if you can make that test by stopping, then that means that you're not an alcoholic because you were able to stop. And you're going to get other benefits, and maybe a better memory might just be one of them. I would think that that might be something that you would want to try.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Alcohol is a sedative, a depressing drug. It slows down brain activity. And as a result of that, it negatively affects the brain's natural healing processes by sleep. It makes sleep regulation difficult.
One of the things that that a central nervous system depressant does is it sedates you. So as a sleep aid, if you look at the immediate effect of drinking alcohol, yeah, you might think that, hey, this is a great sleep aid. Not the case, because what it does is it damages your rapid eye movement, your REM sleep, and it makes your sleep less restful through the night. As a result, I mean, that nighttime, your rest, and people who experience like the third shift know that, okay, for those first few weeks adjusting to a third shift, your brain just ain't working because you're not getting the restful sleep. You've messed with your sleep cycles. Alcohol does that even more effectively, disrupting sleep cycles. And this is when your body is making the necessary repairs it needs for longevity. If we didn't sleep, we would die because our body doesn't have that time to rejuvenate, to reload on the cells. Their brain cells, liver cells, you know, to work with your circadian rhythm to regenerate your body. And alcohol is terrible for its damage to sleep. And sleep is essential for every function that we have. Quality, restful sleep, that is.
Okay, so on your wrist side of the Franklin model, put something down about the problems that alcohol causes with sleep, and sleep is necessary to be able to repair your body. Now, the next thing is a statement that you made. Fetal alcohol syndrome now outranks Down syndrome and autism in prevalence. Would you give us a little feedback on that?
Of course, over the past few years, we've redefined both fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, or autism. You know, we've defined what is on the autism spectrum over and over again. But if we look at FASD, fetal alcohol syndrome or spectrum disorder, FASD, a child is born with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder every 4.5 minutes. That's that outranks both Down syndrome and autism in the rate that we're creating children with lifelong disabilities. The notion of treating something, you don't know necessarily what you can do in your diet leading through conception and through gestation. You don't know what you can do in your diet to prevent something like Down syndrome or autism. But you know, here is a big one, more prevalent than either one of those, that you know in your diet, all you got to do is not drink. And you prevent lifelong disability for a child. That's a no-brainer right there. But the substance use or substance abuse mental health services administration, commonly called SAMHSA or SAMHSA, they look at where the risk is, and it's not just for women who are alcoholics. Even infrequent social drinking is dangerous. If we say that there's no known safe level of drinking for adults, this baby, this fetus that is developing new tissue every second that it's creating life inside of a belly, that definitely applies that no mom is going to be safe.
Yeah, there's no safe level of alcohol use during pregnancy, and alcohol can kill your baby. Pretty heady thing to think about. It doesn't happen all the time, but it can happen. And do you want, if you're pregnant, do you want to kill your baby? No, you don't. Okay. Well, no. We've reached the end of our time for this segment. We'll have the fourth segment next week, and keep going so that you can absolutely make a decision, do I want to drink alcohol? And Scott, it's so great for you to be on the program and be able to share your experience with all the studies that you've looked at, and so that we're not just talking about he said, she said, but we're talking about facts. And so much for the time that you're spending with this program. It's going to help a lot of people.
Glad to do it, Dr. Henderson, and thanks again. This dialogue has been great so far, and let's keep it going.